The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, a special edition of Word of Mouth. NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with JoJo Moyes, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. JoJo Moyes published 8 novels before hitting on the plucky character of Louisa Clark. The relentlessly cheery protagonist charmed millions of readers in Me Before You, a best-selling book and later high-grossing film. Here's Amelia Clark as the cafe clerk turned caretaker, Louisa, ribbing the wealthy and handsome disabled man that she works for, played by actor Sam Claflin.
I'm happy here.
Well, you shouldn't be.
Oh, you want to be more like the girls you know, do you? Want to go to London, marry somebody like Rupert.
I believe he's taken.
And ignore the fact that he's shagging his secretary within 5 years. And have sex once every 6 weeks and listen to him going on and on about how much he adores the children while doing nothing to actually take care of them.
And yes, in case you're wondering, they did fall in love. Many tears and trials later comes Still Me, the third in the Louisa Clark series. Moyes read from the beginning of the novel in front of a live audience at the Music Hall in Portsmouth.
It was the moustache that reminded me I was no longer in England. A solid, grey millipede firmly obscuring the man's upper lip. A village people moustache. A cowboy moustache. The miniature head of a broom that meant business. You just didn't get that kind of moustache at home. I couldn't tear my eyes from it. Ma'am? Oh, I should actually say here, I apologise in advance for my really bad American accent. Don't be distracted. Ma'am? The only person I had ever seen with a moustache like that at home was Mr. Naylor, our maths teacher, and he collected digestive crumbs in his. We used to count them during algebra. Ma'am? Oh, sorry. The man in the uniform motioned me forward with a flick of his stubby finger. He did not look up from his screen. I waited at the booth, long haul sweat drying gently into my dress. He held up his hand, waggling 4 fat fingers. This, I grasped after several seconds, was a demand for my passport. Name? It's there, I said. Your name, ma'am. Louise Elizabeth Clark, I peered over the counter, though I never actually used the Elizabeth bit because my mum realised after they named me that that would make me Lou Lizzie, and if you say it really fast, it sounds like lunacy. And though my dad says that's kind of fitting, not that I'm a lunatic. I mean, you wouldn't want lunatics in your country, huh? My voice bounced nervously off the plexiglass screen. The man looked at me for the first time. He had solid shoulders and a gaze that could pin you like a taser. He did not smile. He waited until my own faded. Sorry, I said. People in uniform make me nervous. I glanced behind me at the immigration hall, at the snaking queue that had doubled back on itself so many times it had become an impenetrable, restless sea of people. I think I'm feeling a bit odd from standing in that queue. That is honestly the longest queue I've ever stood in. I'd begun to wonder whether to start my Christmas list. Put your hand on the scanner. Is it always that size? The scanner? He frowned. No, the queue. But he was no longer listening. He was studying something on his screen. I put my fingers on the little pad, and then my phone dinged. It was Mum. Have you landed? I went to tap an answer with my free hand, but he turned sharply towards me. Ma'am, you are not permitted to use cell phones in this area. Oh, it's just my mum. She wants to know if I'm here. I surreptitiously tried to press the thumbs up emoji as I slid the phone out of view. Reason for travel? What is that? Mum's immediate reply came. She had taken to texting like a duck to water and could now do it faster than she could speak, which was basically warp speed. You know my phone doesn't do the little pictures. Is that an SOS? Louisa, tell me you're okay. Reasons for travel, ma'am? The moustache twitched with irritation. He added slowly, what are you doing here in the United States? Oh, I have a new job. Which is? I'm going to work for a family in New York. Central Park. Just briefly, the man's eyebrows might have raised a millimetre. He checked the address on my form, confirming it. What kind of job? It's a bit complicated, but I'm sort of a paid companion. A paid companion? Well, it's like this. I used to work for this man. I was his companion, but I would also give him his meds and take him out and feed him. That's not as weird as it sounds, by the way. He had no use of his hands. It wasn't like something pervy. Anyway, my last job ended up as more than that because it's hard not to get close to the people that you work with. And Will, the man, well, he was amazing. And, well, we fell in love. Too late, I felt the familiar welling of tears. I wiped at my eyes briskly. So I think it'll be sort of like that. Except for the love bit and the feeding. The immigration officer was staring at me. I tried to smile. Actually, I don't normally cry talking about jobs. I'm not like an actual lunatic, despite my name. But I really loved him, and he loved me. And then, well, he chose to end his life. And so this is sort of my attempt to start over. The tears were now leaking relentlessly, embarrassingly from the corners of my eyes. I couldn't seem to stop them. I couldn't seem to stop anything. I'm sorry, it must be the jet lag. It's something like 2 o'clock in the morning in real time, right? Plus, I don't generally talk about him anymore. I mean, I have a new boyfriend, and he's great. He's a paramedic and hot. That's like winning the boyfriend lottery, right? A hot paramedic? I scrabbled around in my handbag for a tissue. When I looked up, the man was holding out a box. I took one. Thank you. So anyway, my friend Nathan, he's from New Zealand. He works here and he helped me get this job. And I don't really know what it involves yet, apart from looking after this rich man's wife who apparently gets depressed. But I've decided this time I'm going to live up to what Will wanted for me. Because before, I didn't get it right. I just ended up working in an airport. I froze. Not that there's anything wrong with working at an airport. I'm sure immigration is a very important job, really important. But I have a plan. I'm going to do something new every week that I'm here, and I'm going to say yes. Say yes to new things. Will always said I shut myself off from new experiences, so this is my plan. The officer studied my paperwork. You didn't fill the address section out properly. I need a zip code. He pushed the form towards me. I checked the number on the sheet that I'd printed out and filled it in with trembling fingers. I glanced to my left, where the queue at my section was growing restive. At the front of the next queue, a Chinese family was being questioned by two officials. As the woman protested, they were led into a side room. I felt suddenly very alone. The immigration officer peered at the people waiting, and then, abruptly, he stamped my passport. "Good luck, Louisa Clark," he said. I stared at him. "That's it? That's it." I smiled. "Oh, thank you. That's really kind. I mean, it's quite weird being on the other side of the world by yourself for the first time, and now I feel a bit like I just met my first nice new person, and you need to move along now, ma'am." "Of course. Sorry." I gathered up my belongings and pushed a sweaty front of hair from my face. "And ma'am?" "Yes?" I wondered what I'd got wrong now. He didn't look up from his screen. "Be careful what you say yes to." I'm going to tell you why I set this book in the States and in New York in particular. And to do that, I'm just going to tell you a very brief bit about my own history with New York. The first time I ever went to New York was about 25 years ago. And I went for a long weekend with a girlfriend and I had such a good time. I think I didn't sleep for like 3 days. And then I got on the flight to come home and it was one of those nightmare flights where the turbulence is so bad that the trolleys actually start going up and down the aisle and people are screaming and praying. What I didn't realize until I tried to get on another flight sometime after this was this had left me with a kind of pathological fear of flying, so bad that when I got on a flight and the plane started to take off, my knees would knock together so hard that they would make a sound. And this just got worse and worse until it became easier for me just not to fly. Eventually, Me Before You happened. And a couple of things happened when Me Before You first took off in the UK, one of which is I sold the film rights really quickly. Everyone was very enthusiastic, and then I waited for lawyers to do their thing. And then I got a phone call saying, the deal's off. I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, Harvey Weinstein..." This is my own little Weinstein story. Harvey Weinstein had decided to put out an announcement that he was doing his own film about a similar subject matter, which was an English language remake of a very famous French film called The Untouchables, which is about a quadriplegic man in a wheelchair who takes on a young African man as his carer, and it's about the relationship between them. I didn't even know this film existed. And basically everything fell apart because nobody wanted to go up against Harvey Weinstein. So the deal was off. And I, you know, went home and kicked a few walls and felt bitter. And then I thought, you know what, this book has done so well already. I can't be churlish. I just have to get over myself and get on with it. And I had bigger things to worry about, such as the fact that I now had to fly to New York for the first time. Really very nervous. I had some Valium. Rang my husband, obviously, to say goodbye forever, and it was nice knowing him. And he said, you need to just distract yourself. Why don't you turn on the entertainment system? Guess what the first film that came up was? The Untouchables. Anyway, the upshot was, it's a really good film, especially if you've taken a shedload of Valium and some champagne, because I laughed, I cried, I flew a little bit. It was a very entertaining film. Anyway, and the flight just passed in no time, amazingly. But that started a whole new love affair with New York, because when I arrived, you know, 20 years pretty much since I'd last been, all I could think was, why did I not come back here sooner? I had sudden envy for people who got to live there because it was so exciting, and I was basically looking at it through the eyes of an alien because I'd had so little to do with it. Here's the thing about writing about New York is it's been done already, and it's probably been done better than anybody else can do it subsequently. So I thought if I decided to write about this city, the only way I could do it was not as someone who understood it better than a New Yorker, but as an alien, if you see what I mean. I mean, obviously I'm not green with stuff hanging around. But I used to be a journalist many years ago, and one of the things that has really helped my writing has been the understanding that to bring something to life on a page, you have to experience it. You know, I know a lot of writers now don't go further than Google because they say you can get everything. You can get the pictures, you can do Street View, you can, you know, you can find out every single fact you need to know. Well, I don't agree with that, because what I find is that when you go to somewhere, you hear different rhythms in people's speech. You smell the smells. You know, in New York, there's quite a few of those. There's, you know, you see the things on the sidewalk. You hear the noise levels, you know, which if you live in the country like I do, it's just kind of enormous, the way the sound bounces off the buildings, the way the buildings are so insanely tall. So that's what I was trying to do, is replicate the view of somebody who hadn't been there before. And one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to set a scene at 30 Rock, at the top of the Rockefeller Center, because I felt like, well, the Empire State's been done. Has anybody done 30 Rock? And if you go onto Google to do your research, what you will find on TripAdvisor and Google is that you go into an elevator, you go up 60 floors, something like that, and then you come out the top and there's an amazing view. Guess what? It's not like that in real life. In real life, you have to basically navigate your way to the tower from, you know, lots of other bits of Rockefeller, which I knew nothing about. And then you go into an elevator and you brace yourself for this, you know, stratospheric rise. It goes whoop, and then it stops at another floor, and everybody gets shoved out. And you go, well, what happens now? Do I have to walk? Then you go into another elevator, but before then you have to go through a whole museum thing and loads of pictures, and then you have to sit on a girder and have someone take your picture and tell you to kiss someone that you've never met before so they can take your picture and sell it to you at the other end. And the more of these things I got put through, the more I kept thinking, okay, this is a completely different thing. And then you get to the top and you go, oh, okay, I'm up here, it's beautiful. Oh, but hang on, that's not the top. This is the top. So then you go up another layer. So basically, pretty much everything here I have done, and I have corrected my views of myself. I loved writing this book. I think partly because I knew it was the last time I was going to visit Lou in novel form. I haven't ruled out maybe a short story sometime in the future. I find her such an easy character to inhabit, and that doesn't often happen. And so really, the hardest thing was working out what I wanted to do and what I wanted to say with this book, because a book is never just a book. A book is also the thing that you want to say, which runs underneath the plot and underneath everything that happens. And I had become aware through the success of Me Before You and After You that Lou had this whole army of female followers, often quite young, you know, often sort of teens to late 20s. And, you know, we live in strange times. There's a lot of politics and a lot of stuff going on. That's all I'm going to say on that matter. But what I realized was that it was really important to me that what I did with Louisa meant that at the end of this book, I might not be able to solve anything. You know, I'm just a writer of commercial fiction, but I didn't want to be part of the problem. It was really important to me that I wasn't telling her audience, your life is going to be perfect if you meet the right man, or if you suddenly have kind of huge financial success, or, you know, you wear the right shoes or buy the right handbag, because life isn't like that. And I considered a lot of things to do to Reese. I even considered killing her off at one point, but then, you know, my husband was like, no. Well, because I thought she could be with Will, and it would be kind of ghostly and lovely, and he was just like, no. Absolutely not. So anyway, she doesn't die. I'm just going to tell you that in advance. It's not a spoiler. But I hope that you feel where Louisa ends up at the end of this book is satisfying, and it is the right place for her to end up.
Author Jojo Moyes reported live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Up next, I'll talk with Moyes about uncovering the secret lives of New York's uber-rich, why she wouldn't wish her work ethic on anyone, and how she gave up on trying to be the woman who does it all. I'm Virginia Prescott. That's when Writers on a New England Stage continues with Jojo Moyes on this special edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Jojo Moyes, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Jojo Moyes left a successful career in journalism 15 years ago and is now an international best-selling author and screenwriter. She writes romance novels, popular commercial fiction, the kind of books overlooked by literary awards and gobbled up by devoted readers. The genre is home turf for relatably flawed characters, plot twists, and meet-cutes. Things get a little deeper in Jojo Moyes' hands. Her breakthrough novel, Me Before You, highlighted class disparities, sexual trauma, and the right to die. I sat down with Jojo Moyes on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth to talk about some of those big-picture issues encountered in her newest novel, Still Me. So, Jojo, what a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Really, really glad you're here. You talked about Louisa landing in New York, and she goes to work for this ultra-wealthy family, mm-hmm. the Gopniks. And you said, you know, you talked about doing your research in New York, but those big apartment buildings on the Upper East Side, there are a lot of secrets there and a lot of servants who don't normally tell those secrets. So how did you get a view inside?
Well, I have a friend called Monica Lewinsky, who...
Way to open.
she doesn't live there, I hasten to add, but she has some really interesting friends. And so I asked her if she knew anybody who might be willing to let a really nosy writer come and sniff around their apartment. And it's testament to her kind of charm and nice friends that that happened. And so we had tea. And she also introduced me to an amazing realtor who's been selling those buildings for donkey's years. And between the two of them, I really got to find out about the kind of blood flow around the buildings, because it was really important to me that that building become a character in itself. I really like the way that those buildings, you know, do start to become characters. The fact that the East Side, you know, the buildings tend to be older and often they have terrible plumbing, like all the things that you just wouldn't expect. And the fact that because everything is a co-op and has to run by a board, nothing ever gets changed because people don't like the change. And whereas on the other side, you have the kind of really filthy rich people, the oligarchs and the pop stars who all have swimming pools and 24-hour restaurants downstairs and creches and gyms and cinemas and all the rest of it. It was just fascinating. But it's like that thing in London. If you live in North London, you almost never go south and vice versa. And I can tell as an ex-Londoner whether someone comes from North or South London. I can even hear it in their voice. And I thought, it must be the same in New York. You must be able to know.
Well, part of the microcosm inside of this building, yeah. the Lavery, are the servant class,
yeah.
who, in this case, they're actually asked to wear uniforms. I mean, not
yes.
super strict uniforms, but I think somebody tells her, Louisa, in the beginning, it's best to know where everyone stands.
That is actually a phrase that someone told me. One of the weird side effects of the success of the books over the past few years is that I have had access to some people's lives that I might not otherwise have had. And that was a phrase that was used to me about someone with staff. And I think if you have grown up without staff, as most of us may have done, there is something quite strange about the way that the super rich live an observed life, a life in which their home, their refuge, is the workplace to kind of teams of people. And so they can never entirely relax because there's this sort of bizarre charade of people pretending that nobody's looking when everybody knows that everybody's looking. You know, the servants know everything about those lives. They may know more than the husband or wife know, and yet everybody pretends that that's not the case because there's no other way to live that life. And I just, you know, as a novelist, you're really fascinated by tension. That's the thing that drives a narrative. And for me, that tension between maybe not wanting people around but being entirely dependent on those people was a really strange one.
But this is not the first book where you had this working class woman set into this world of, you know, the super, super rich. What is it about that works for you?
So for me, this is about money more than class. The thing that interested me about the relationship between Mr. Gopnik's ex-wife and the kind of circle that they moved in that they won't now allow his second wife to move into is you can see that in almost any social strata. It doesn't actually have to be the wealthy. It could be, you know, it could be a working man's club in New Jersey. If you get that second wife coming in and there's kind of a handful of 50-year-old wives who are looking at their own husband going, don't even think about it. You know, that young wife is going to get the same reception. It's just that when you also introduce money, there's a whole new layer of tension because the kids are thinking she's going to pop out a sprog and then that's going to be it. There's my inheritance, gone. And that just adds to more. Or that was just my thinking of it. Okay.
Well, this woman, her name is Agnes. She's stunningly beautiful, Eastern European woman, a much younger wife of a one percenter. When did you start writing this book exactly?
This is the weird thing. I started writing this book a long time before any other women who resemble that description in any way may have come to public prominence. And it was only when I'd finished that I was describing the book to someone, a friend of mine, and she was just like, have you just written a Melania book? And I was just like, oh, no. You know what? I think Agnes may not be the only young, beautiful second wife of a one percenter. She's not, well, I don't know Melania. Perhaps she is very like Melania. But in my head, she's not like Melania. Although I think there is a certain survivor instinct that has to possibly come into play to exist in that sphere. That's probably all I'm going to say.
Well, many people would look at her and think she won the lottery. You know, yeah. She was not wealthy. She's got this very rich husband who adores her. You know, she basically shops and works out and wears couture gowns.
Yeah, all her problems are luxury problems.
Her problems are. So how do you write a character like that and make her sympathetic? Because I think she is. You know, you feel for her.
Do you know, there's an interview that stayed with me. I've got jet lag brain. Who wrote Eat, Pray, Love?
Elizabeth Gilbert.
And I read an interview with her where she did an amazing thing after she achieved kind of huge financial success. And she gave away huge amounts of money to her close friends so they could pay off their mortgages. And she thought this was a really great thing to do because she felt so lucky. She just wanted to make sure everybody else felt that way. And I thought, yep, that would be a kind of fairly fundamental impulse to kind of improve everybody's lives. And she said the worst thing happened, which was that some of them didn't want to talk to her anymore. Because for them, she had removed something that they were aspiring to that they hadn't realized they needed it. And also they felt obligated to her in a weird way. And it was the first time I kind of thought about the fact that, you know, you can joke about the phrase luxury problems, but it can be a problem. And what that money had done was isolate her from her friends in a way that was totally unexpected. So when I thought about Agnes, I thought about the fact that there might be a degree of resentment among her friends that she had kind of won the lottery, as you say. But there was also a pride, you know, that people don't always want to be given things. They want to earn things and they want to be your equal. They don't want to feel like the poor relation. And Agnes's friends are proud women, so they didn't want to do it. And in the end, it just becomes easier not to rub up against that person. It's just easier to avoid them because the feelings that someone's success on that level can induce are so complicated and maybe tell you something not great about yourself. So in the end, it's easier not to see them at all.
Yeah, she's really isolated.
Yeah, she's isolated.
And her security is kind of based on hiding things. You know, they're erasing fundamental parts of herself,
yes.
Let's say.
Well, that fascinates me. You know, I grew up with two parents who basically told me I could do anything if I wanted to. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of money growing up, but what I did feel, I grew up with this slightly insane belief that I really could do anything. So when I was in my early 20s, I would fix cars. I would, you know, lay on my mum would come visit and I would be on my back under a car, and she sort of, I could tell she thought she'd maybe gone too far, and she said to me once, you know, you have to leave a man somewhere to go. She's like, and I'm like, Mom, you betrayer of your sex, you know. Sorry, I've completely lost my thread now.
Well, we were talking about at what cost we do this, yeah, as women, you know, the parts we leave behind.
It's that phrase, isn't it? You can't have it all. I don't think I realized that till I had children. I don't know. I think there's a whole generation of women who had to sacrifice one part of themselves. I know so many women, even in my family, who were not allowed to work, you know, and bring up a family, or were not allowed to pursue a career because their husband's career was more important and it was too difficult to juggle it all. And on the other side, I know women who really prioritized their career and suddenly found that they didn't have a husband, or they didn't have children, or they had to kind of accommodate a different kind of life. And very few people get the whole shebang. And that's something you kind of work out more and more as you get older, I guess. Everybody pays with something. Sorry.
You're listening to author and screenwriter JoJo Moyes, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. You just made me think of something. And in the book, we have the example of Louisa's mom, who, you know, if you've read her previous books, is a really endearing character. But she's unable to see who she is or what she is if she's not being a caregiver, right?
Yeah.
Taking care of other people. And, you know, the role beyond what do you do when people aren't depending upon me? And I wondered, you know, because you have written this about Louisa in a lot of detail, have you ever been that caregiver?
Oh, God. It's been part of my life for so long. You know, I'm just one of these people who looks after other people. I think it's either kind of in you into a sort of crazy extent. So while I was through college, I would look after my grandmother who was sick and who lived nearby. It didn't trouble me at all because I loved her and you know, it was just the deal. And then you have kids and you look after them. And I don't think my husband has that same impulse. I think that would be a kind way of putting it. I think it's probably quite a female thing. And so much of your energy can go into it. I am so grateful that I do a job that I love and that I've also shown that to my kids. You know, I occasionally talk about this, and I really hope I don't get kind of hissed at, because you never know how people are going to react. But a good friend of mine told me a few years ago that if you are a parent, you can only really do one other thing well. And that really stayed with me, because I'd always been one of these people who, you know, I was trying to kind of bake the perfect cake, and I was kind of trying to keep the perfect home and wax the bits of me that needed waxing and, you know, do the date night and do 89 blooming things and try and fit them in around everything else. And it was so liberating just hearing that. Like, I thought, actually, what is my priority? My priority is to do the job that I love and that I seem to be quite successful at. But equally, I have three kids who need me. And what I found that I was doing, which I think, again, is a very maternal or parental thing, every time they wanted me, I was like, yeah, just let me do this cooking, just let me do this ironing, just, you know, I just got to do this thing in the garden and then I'm going to be with you. And you suddenly realize that they're not going to be with you forever. So I decided that I was going to contract out every single thing that I could contract out. And when I wasn't writing, I was going to sit on the sofa and cuddle my kids and talk to them about stuff, or just walk the dogs with them, or Oh, thank you. I prefer the clapping to the hissing. But it's funny, because some, you say that to some audiences, and not all women want to hear it, because it's a very, it's almost a radical thing to say, I'm going to be a mum, but I'm not necessarily going to be a homemaker, because I can't do everything. You know, we say, yeah, sure, you can do it all. No, I don't have a social life. Like, I literally don't have a social life. And that's fine, too, because something has to give. That's what Facebook's for, right?
All right, so you've talked a little bit about, you know, who you've decided to be as a parent and mm-hmm. a writer. What advice do you have for writers to become as prolific as you are is a question from the audience.
Okay, I'm going to say something radically. I'm not sure you should be as prolific as me because I'm really, really tired all the time. I'm so tired. I think you should just work at your own pace is the answer. It suits me to work really hard.
Which means do you like have a daily writing schedule for
yeah,
the most part?
I mean, for a long time, I used to get up at 6 and I would literally start work from the moment I woke up. I mean, with help, my husband would literally go downstairs, make the coffee, wake me up, put the coffee in one hand and put my laptop in my lap and just go start and then leave me to it. And I would be writing before my eyes were properly open. So I could often get 500 words done before breakfast. And then I would do all the other things that needed doing around breakfast. And then I would go to work. Now my kids get up even earlier and I just can't do 5:30. I'm just too old and tired and I don't want to look like a sad horse every day. So I'm now at the stage where I tend to just write in the mornings. I do my admin in the afternoon and walk the dog and all that kind of stuff and just try and do what I can. But I don't have a set schedule.
So I have a question here. Do you ever cry or become really emotional when you are writing a moment?
If I don't cry, you won't cry. That's no, it's true. When I wrote the final letter in Me Before You, I cried so hard that the guy in the next office, who actually didn't like me very much, came next door to see if I was okay. And he knocked on the door and opened it and he said, is everything all right? And I went, yeah, it's going really well. It's really good. I'm so happy. And he was just like, okay, just going to leave that there. What I found over the years is you have to feel it because it has to come from somewhere honest. I don't think you can write cynically and make people laugh or cry because I think it shows on the page. So to do that, you have to feel the things that your character is feeling. And if I can't make myself teary or make myself laugh, then something's not working. To make myself properly sob in a day is a really good day's work. Yeah.
How about humor? You know, you tackle some really big topics, but there's a lot of humor, especially in the Louisa Clark books. Is that something that you found as a way to, I don't know, help the medicine?
Well, I've only introduced humor after Me Before You. I'd written 8 books before then, which didn't have a funny word in them.
Okay, can I tell you something a little funny?
Okay.
Today I was speaking with my colleagues and saying, how can I ask her why she wasn't funny before this?
Why weren't you funny? I just didn't think I could do comedy. It didn't occur to me that I could be funny. And then when I came up with the idea for Me Before You, which was sort of loosely based on a news story that was in England at the time, I pitched this idea to my agent and I could see she was like, okay, that's quite a bleak story. And in England, I don't know if it's the same here, but in England, we tend to disguise high emotion with really bad jokes. It's like, it's our way of dealing with real emotion. So like our emergency services have the blackest humor. It's that they're very funny and it's probably, you know, not to everybody's taste, but that's how we respond. And so I thought the only way I can make this book palatable, because it's going to be grueling in places, is if I also make people laugh. And so I just tried to introduce humor and touch wood, it balanced it out.
Novelist Jojo Moyes recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Her newest book is called Still Me. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, I'll talk with JoJo Moyes about why she didn't anticipate the disability community's response to Me Before You, and how American audiences respond to melancholy compared to the rest of the world. I'm Virginia Prescott. More Writers on New England Stage coming up after the break. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with JoJo Moyes, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Moyes wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation of her novel Me Before You. The movie starred Emilia Clarke of Game of Thrones fame as Louisa, and actor Sam Claflin, late of The Hunger Games, as Will Traynor. The film's central tension is Will's determination to end his life rather than continue living with the debilitating effects of a severe spinal cord injury. The movie was a real weeper and a huge hit, and caught a lot of flack from disability rights activists, anti-euthanasia groups, and some fans who wondered why Louisa's history of sexual trauma was left out. I asked JoJo about that during our interview on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, and included questions submitted by the audience, like this one. How did she come up with the character of Louisa Clarke?
Do you know, I have no idea. She just landed in my lap, and my God, if I could make that happen again, I would, because it happens so rarely. Usually, I spend months thinking about characters. I have this whole routine where I buy an A4 hardback book with no lines, got to be no lines, and I have nice pens, and I start sketching characters, and I invent histories for them. I, you know, want to know what their parents did, where they grew up, what food they like to eat, what music they listen to. I do a thing called the kick the dog test. There's no dogs harmed in this test. I have my character walk down a road in my imagination and see someone kicking a dog. What do they do? Do they intervene? Do they throw a punch at the person kicking the dog? Do they kick the dog? Are they a psychopath? You know, those sorts of tests tell you an awful lot about a character. So usually I go through all these insane hoops before I even start. And then Louisa just fell into my lap, as did Will. And it was really strange because I knew, I saw one scene in my head, which was the wheelchair dance at the wedding. Mm. And the exchange between them where he says, "You would have never let me look at your breasts like that if I wasn't in a wheelchair." And she says, "You would have never looked at my breasts if you weren't in a wheelchair." And in those two lines, I knew exactly how they were to each other, that level of honesty, not letting each other get away with anything, a bit of humor, a little bit kind of flirty. And the characters just went outwards from that one scene.
Well, you must have known going into that book that you'd face a lot of scrutiny for how disability was portrayed, or did you?
No, not at all. And I tell you why, because no one was reading my books. So I just thought I was writing it for me. In fact, you know, my husband used to joke that because of the subject matter, he said, "This is going to be the book that finally finishes your career." And he's nice like that. I did say Englishmen's humor is kind of... We're still married. But I wanted to... So here's the thing, and I don't really talk about this much, but my younger son is disabled. He was born disabled. He's profoundly deaf. And one of the things you learn very quickly if you're the parent of a disabled child is that the disability doesn't matter. You know, you have a couple of weeks or maybe longer where you're slightly in shock because you have to adjust all your expectations, not your feelings, but your expectations about what they may or may not achieve and what you can want for them and what you can expect. You know, it's a steep learning curve. But very quickly, I realized that the problem did not lie with him. It lay with people's expectations and reactions to him. And I was quite spiky and defensive of how people were around him. You know, some people called him a tragedy, which I just wanted to punch them in the face. So anyway, part of the thinking when I started this book was I wanted to create a character where people very quickly felt that the disability was the least important thing about him. Mm. And the thing that I loved when that book came out was that women would fall in love with Will Traynor very quickly. And so the huge volume of letters and emails that I got in the first few years I would say 70% of them were women who were in love with Will Traynor, who wanted to talk about him and, or wanted to tell me off for the ending. And that's what I felt that I had done, which was create someone who was three-dimensional, who was crabby and intelligent and annoying and handsome and sexy and all those many things that, you know, people are. And in fact, it wasn't till the film came out that, you know, the reaction changed. And it was quite a lesson to me in nuance, if you like, because I think you are able to convey things in a book that you possibly can't do in a film because of the structure, because of the way films are, and also possibly because of the wider reach of films. Mm-hmm. You know, things are reacted to in a very different way.
But you did write the screenplay for
I did write the screenplay.
So what was that like for you? I mean, because obviously there were things that didn't make it into the book,
sure.
Or there are things you were attached to. What was that process like?
Well, it was really good for me, and I'm very conscious saying that a lot of writers who go to Hollywood have a truly terrible time. There were some scenes that I had to leave out. You'll be aware that the maze scene was missing from the film. I don't want to be too specific in case there's somebody young or sensitive. Something happens to Louisa in a maze that's not very nice. And when I write this in the book, I kind of write it in a very opaque way so that you're not entirely sure what has happened until quite a bit later. It's not spelt out. What we found was that every time I rewrote it, it overshadowed everything else. It overshadowed their relationship. It became kind of the focus of the story itself, which it wasn't meant to be. And so in the end, we had to drop it. And it was really interesting because it's the thing that I get asked about most, but I still don't see how we could have done it because it would have changed the whole tone of the film.
I'm Virginia Prescott with the author Jojo Moyes. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire for Writers on a New England Stage. Well, I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, Louisa has this traumatic history, mm-hmm. and this is, you know, an issue that so many people have hidden.
Oh, yeah.
And now very much in the public eye. And so why create that backstory for her?
In truth, because it is so many women's lived reality. It's been really interesting, this Me Too thing, the conversations that it's opened up. And I think one of the things that I have found a bit destabilizing, but also weirdly liberating because of the way women are supporting each other, is how many women have suffered things that they've just assimilated, that they've just gone, okay, well, you know, that's it. And that event was inspired by something that happened to somebody I knew. I just think just because you write women's commercial fiction, or however we want to describe it, and it might be funny, and it might be, you know, might have a kind of lightweight cover, doesn't mean you can't tackle quite sticky issues, you know, things that are prevalent in life now. You know, there are political elements to my books, but they're sugar-coated, generally. I don't believe in kind of hammering things home, but I do like to write about things that might make people think a little bit.
Well, like, you know, end-of-life decisions. This is a huge deal. I do have a reader from China who mm-hmm. asks, why did Will choose to die in Me Before You, which I think is a really big question, but maybe more, do you agree with his decision to die?
I don't know is the answer. And I guess my feeling when I wrote the book was that I didn't know, but what I didn't want to do was judge. Here's the thing. The book was inspired by a true life event that I heard. I was driving my kids back from school one day. I didn't contract that one out. And I heard this story on a radio about a young sportsman who had been left quadriplegic after an accident and several years later had persuaded his parents to take him to Dignitas, which is the Center for Assisted Suicide in
Same
Switzerland.
Same place in Switzerland, right?
Yeah. And I was so shocked by this story. It actually felt like someone had punched me. And I don't know if it's because my kids were young or what, but it just, I kept thinking, how could any mother, because we always judge the mom, right? How could any mother agree to do that? I couldn't get it. I couldn't get my head around it at all. Well, here's the thing. I realized that life isn't black and white like that. The more I read around this topic, the more I read about this family, what happened to this young man, I discovered that I couldn't judge him. I couldn't judge his family and I couldn't judge him because what they were in was this extraordinary set of circumstance. And he was an extraordinary man. And that's the key. He did not react the way most people react. And the strangest coincidence, while we were filming, we had a number of people on set whose job, who were either quadriplegic or whose job was working with quadriplegics, because we wanted to get the technicalities right. We wanted to make sure that we didn't get anything wrong. And one of these people worked with the young man who had taken his own life. And one day I talked to her about him, and she said in her career, of all the hundreds of people that she's worked with, there had only ever been two people who she knew she couldn't get through to, and he was one of them. Oh. It was like a wall had gone up and she couldn't break it down. And that's the topic I was kind of interested in. What if the person who you love refuses to play ball? What happens if everybody knows that the right thing is for them to want to live and they're just not having it? When I write, the issues that really fascinate me are the ones where there are no clear answers. And for me, there is no clear answer on that topic.
Well, it's obviously a really complicated decision. Mm. And in the book After You, you know, Louisa's really living with the consequences of it.
Well, that was one of the things I kept thinking about after the book, which was, you know, the book, Me Before You, ends on a semi-hopeful note. Mm. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, I cannot imagine the consequences would be easy to live with. You know, if you are a sensitive person, as Louisa clearly is, and you had just helped somebody you love and their own life, I think you would be devastated by it. And I think those consequences would live with you for an awful long time. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't actually mean for After You to be as melancholy a book as it ended up. But the thing is, you know, we were talking about inhabiting characters. Mm-hmm. You have to be true to your character. And she was just really sad.
Yeah, and she, you know, she did travel, she did buy a flat, but she kind of reverted to a life that felt safe to her, probably,
exactly,
you know, part
because
of her trauma.
I can't imagine the guilt. Yeah. I can't imagine, you know, if I put myself in her shoes, you would blame yourself.
But you alluded to this when you were speaking earlier, the kind of idea that, you know, this was not a fairy tale. And, you know, I wonder, did people resist that, resent that, that you weren't sort of giving her this beautiful life of liberation after?
Do you want to hear something funny?
Please.
Only here.
Only in the U.S.
Do you know what? I think Europeans are much more comfortable with the idea of melancholy than Americans. I think you guys are perhaps naturally more optimistic than we are. We're quite glum. We don't expect a lot. It's all going to be miserable anyway. You're going to die soon. So, you know, it's like the Germans, they lapped it up. Norwegians, yeah, gimme. Swedish, you know, all those Scandinavian countries, they were like, we're totally okay with sad Lou. The Americans were like, why can't she cheer herself up a bit? You know, what happened to the old Louisa Clark? Where's the bounce, you know? It was quite funny because, you know, the books are successful all over the world now, and to see the different reactions in different countries is quite eye-opening. But yeah, it didn't go down well here in the same way that the first one did. I'm sorry. Third one's more cheerful.
Well, you did say, you know, this is the third and the last of Louisa Clark novels. Mm-hmm. How do you know when to let go of a character?
Well, when I decided to write a sequel to Me Before You, I straight away saw it as a three. I saw it as a horseshoe shape, which was that, you know, maybe before you brought her low, After You is kind of an exploration of grief and how to rise up out of it. And then Still Me is really the coming up again, and Louisa really working out questions of her own identity, having to work out who she is in this new landscape. And it's hard to leave her behind. It's really hard. The more I talk about it, the more I think, why did I do that? But I don't want people to feel like I'm, you know, flogging my little stripy-legged horse to death. I want people to look on her with fondness, and I feel like if I kind of do Louisa's divorce, Louisa's custody battles, Louisa's battle with middle age spread, it's just not going to have the same appeal. Louisa's menopause, yeah.
Join me in thanking JoJo Moyes for being here tonight. JoJo Moyes, novelist, screenwriter, outsourcing mom, and author most recently of the novel Still Me. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage.
The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR president is Betsy Gardella. Producer and communication director is Margaret Talcott. The live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. NHPR broadcast producer Hannah McCarthy and Taylor Quimby. Music hall production manager Jana Morris. Live stage photography from Clear Eye Photo. You can look at the photos and listen to more author interviews from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Just click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott. This has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.